remarkable way. We might think that video game programmers have very little in common with, say, auto workers, but these are both sets of workers who, if you read about what the video game developers are going through, massive overwork, incredible stress, incredible pressure, and huge profits for their employers while they don't see any of their fair share. There's many new union campaigns to look out for, and as we've heard already on this program, you know, when the United Auto Workers strike, and if they win, which I believe that they will, that has effects for everybody else. The UAW is the biggest industrial union in the United States. They historically have played a precedent-setting, pace-setting role for the entire working class, and so that's, you know, it's why we all have to be out there on the picket lines and otherwise supporting them. It'll help us, too.
Alex Press, labor reporter at Jacobin Magazine, will link to your latest article, The UAW Strike Matters for the Entire U.S. Working Class. And Marcelina Pedraza, electrician at Ford Assembly Plant in Chicago, member of UAW Local 551. Coming up, thousands prepare for a major march in New York Sunday to end fossil fuels. We'll speak to a climate scientist just arrested in West Virginia for chaining herself to a drill to protest the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. And we'll speak to NYU students who've just forced New York University to divest from fossil fuel. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ahead of a major march Sunday in New York City to escalate the fight to end fossil fuels, hundreds of climate activists blocked the entrances to Citibank's headquarters in Manhattan Thursday as part of a push to end financing for the fossil fuel industry. At least 25 people were arrested, including Alec Conan, co-director of Stop the Money Pipeline. He spoke to Democracy Now! After his release.
Citibank is the world's second largest funder of fossil fuels. Since the Paris Agreement was signed 7 years ago, which was supposed to be a pivotal turning point in the climate story, Citibank has loaned more than $332 billion to the coal, oil, and gas companies that are fueling the climate crisis and fighting climate action at every turn. And we've been engaging with Citi for years, talking to their senior leadership, encouraging them to listen to us and to start passing policies to stop financing fossil fuel expansion. But they have not listened. And so today, we descended on their headquarters and we blocked 12 entrances to their headquarters and prevented many, many hundreds of their workers from being able to enter the building for an hour or 2 hours.
Also this week, some 400 scientists endorsed the demands of Sunday's March to End Fossil Fuels, part of the global fight to end fossil fuels, which will see actions take place around the world. In an open letter to President Biden, they noted he had vowed to listen to the science in tackling the climate crisis, but, quote, it's clear the crisis is spiraling out of control and the policies of your administration, they said, with regard to fossil fuels, fail to align with what the science tells us must happen to avert calamity, unquote. For more, we're joined by one of the signatories to this letter, Rose Abramoff. She's an earth scientist who was just arrested for chaining herself to a drill in order to shut down construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline in West Virginia, which will carry 2 billion cubic feet of frack gas across Appalachia. This comes after she was fired in January from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory after urging other scientists to take action on climate change. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Dr. Rose Abramoff. It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about 400 scientists have endorsed this march on Sunday, and this is kicking off a week of climate action. What your demands are and the significance of you all being scientists. Many other groups have also endorsed this march.
Thank you for having me on, Amy. So this letter that some 400 scientists have signed is actually very simple. It's one of our shorter letters. It simply asks the Biden administration to meet the demands of the March to End Fossil Fuels, which are essentially to stop federal approval for new fossil fuel projects and repeal permits for major projects like the Willow Project and the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, to phase out fossil drilling on our public lands and waters, to declare a climate emergency, and to design an energy transition that protects workers' rights, which might relate to your earlier segment. And the reason why, you know, we could get into the science of it, we don't actually spend a lot of time in this letter talking about how the continued use of fossil fuels puts us at greater risk of devastating heat and flooding, crop failure, climate migration. You know, the message is very simple. We feel like the science has come to such a complete consensus, and we just want fossil fuels to stop.
So you were arrested, Rose Abramoff, just a week ago when you joined, 4 other activists to block construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline in West Virginia. This is one of the favorite projects of Joe Manchin, the most receives most oil and gas funding of any senator in the U.S. Congress. Can you talk about your action?
Sure. Yeah, I was locked to the drill poised to go under the Greenbrier River, which is the longest undammed river in the eastern United States. A lot of this pipeline overlies this karst geology, which is a very kind of vulnerable and difficult substrate to drill through, and you know, poses a lot of vulnerability for the local environment. And then, of course, we have the basic climate impact of the 90 or so million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year, which we can't afford if we want to meet our climate goals or come anywhere close to meeting our climate goals. And so I was locked on. There were actually 5 elder women who were part of the Rocking Chair Rebellion who were locked on or blocking with me. And, you know, we all felt that this pipeline is emblematic of the larger struggle to transition away from fossil fuels, that we're failing in that struggle right now. And, you know, Senator Manchin, as you said, the champion of the MVP, has received more money from methane gas pipelines than any other lawmaker. And so, you know, there's really, it's really egregious that this is still happening. From a scientific perspective, it's a no-brainer that we shouldn't be expanding fossil fuels, full stop. You know, added to the carbon risk is really the cost to ratepayers and taxpayers, because this needs to become a stranded asset if we're ever going to meet our climate goals. So, you know, this pipeline, which is being built now, really can't and shouldn't be put into service.
I mean, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin recently went to the construction site to speak about how the project is on track, will provide jobs. The company says it wants to finish construction to restore the environment. Your response to these kinds of statements?
Right. Well, I don't think that it's at all accurate to say that building this pipeline will restore the environment. I think it'll do exactly the opposite. And what's left of this pipeline now is still hundreds of water crossings, which are in the sort of riskiest types of construction for the local environment. And then, of course, there's the emissions burden of this pipeline, which I think is fairly obviously a negative impact on the environment. You know, locals don't want this pipeline. The resistance to this pipeline is primarily local. And, you know, it's also been primarily very effective. I sort of find it heartening that this pipeline is 6 years behind schedule and billions of dollars over budget, in part because of these, you know, small locally organized actions, such as the one that we participated in.
I wanted to ask you about one of our news headlines today. We talked about the internal documents from Exxon revealing that executives, including Trump's former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was the former CEO of Exxon, secretly worked to sow doubt about the severity of climate change, even as Exxon publicly acknowledged the link between fossil fuels and the climate crisis. He would go on to become Secretary of State. The Wall Street Journal reports between 2006 and 16, Exxon executives in their internal communications attempted to push back against the notion that humans needed to curtail oil and gas use to help the planet. If you can respond to this.
Sure. First of all, I find it pretty astounding that this article came out in the Wall Street Journal. I'm actually quite heartened that the notoriously business-focused readership of the Wall Street Journal is interested in Exxon's basically decades-long conspiracy to cover up the climate crisis. It makes me feel like we're making some progress in moving towards this shared sense of reality, at least of what Exxon's intentions are. Secondly, I don't at all find it shocking that Exxon's continuing to downplay climate change as late as this last decade. In fact, I would argue that if you did another expose in 10 or so years of communications that are happening right now at these companies, you would find a continued, you know, utter lack of intention to transition their energy holdings. This to me is just like one more line of evidence. There was a study earlier this year in the journal Science that showed that Exxon's internal climate models in the 70s were as accurate as anyone else's in the scientific community at that time. And yet, you know, they continued to fund misinformation think tanks and as this article says, never publicly acknowledged climate change until the mid-2000s. So I feel like the lesson that we should take from all this is that fossil fuel companies like Exxon have no intention of transitioning their energy holdings on their own, that we have to force them to do it.
Finally, you're going to be joining this march on Sunday. But Rose Abramoff, was it worth all that you've done being fired in January from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory after urging other scientists to speak out around climate change and to take action on it? Are you sorry for what you did?
I'm not. I feel like I've tried everything that I could do in order to get this message across and to, you know, get the message out to people that climate activists aren't crazy hippies, that, you know, and scientists aren't exaggerating, that this is a serious issue that we need to address now. I feel like I did everything that I could within the context of behaving well as a scientist, you know, educational programs, policy reports, city council, petitions and marches. I wouldn't feel the need to risk my job with activism, you know, to risk felony level charges by locking myself to a pipeline drill, if I felt like the voice of the scientific community was being properly heard. So I stand by my actions.
Dr. Rose Abramoff, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Earth Scientist. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a major victory for climate activists here in New York when NYU, New York University, announced its plan to divest from fossil fuels after facing over a decade of pressure from student advocates. The chair of the NYU Board of Trustees announced the decision in an August letter addressed to Sunrise NYU and acknowledge them for their work over the years. For more, we're joined by two of the people who were key to this campaign. Alicia Colomer is a co-founder of Sunrise NYU, managing director of Fossil Free Research. And Dylan Wabi is also a co-founder and hub director of Sunrise NYU. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Alicia, let's begin with you. The significance of, well, what exactly did NYU agree to do? And talk about your organizing leading to this.
Yes, thank you for having me. So the fossil fuel industry continues to deny and delay climate action, as we just heard, and it's very important for universities to put their money where their mouth is and actually invest in a just green energy future that they're preparing their students to enter, not continue investing in the industry that is destroying our future. So what NYU has committed to do is to stop giving more money to the industry that is destroying our future, and that is why it is such a crucial decision. But this decision comes after 10 years of student activism and organizing at NYU, and it shouldn't have taken a decade for them to be able to finally make this announcement.
And the announcement was what? And were you surprised? I mean, this is one of the wealthiest universities in the United States, certainly one of the most expensive for tuition. Were you surprised, Alicia, that they congratulated the chair of the board, congratulated NYU Sunrise? You're the co-founder of that organization.
Yes, I was definitely surprised because in most university divestment announcements, student activists aren't recognized in the decision. So it was very gratifying to read that letter from Bill Berkley himself, the chair of our board, congratulating the successes of Sunrise NYU in getting here. And I think that recognition is very well deserved because we have spent so many years building this great organization and running this amazing campaign, and we genuinely could not never have gotten this win without the work of so many student organizers who did everything from organizing protests and rallies to collecting over 2,000 signatures on our petition to working with our student government assembly and the Office of Sustainability. And it just was so many years of work leading up to this decision. And it was very gratifying that the chair of our board was able to recognize that.
And Dylan Wabi, your response as well, as another of the co-founders of Sunrise NYU.
Sunrise NYU is nothing but our people. To be honest, we don't even have a consistent place to meet within NYU. We meet in an empty auditorium, and every now and then it's full with some sort of presentation, and we have to improvise. But we have an incredible leadership and incredible membership. And on top of that, we work with other progressive student organizations, and we work with the unions on campus, the Contract Faculty Union, the Graduate Student Union, Adjunct Union, and others. And through this broad coalition is ultimately what forced the Board of Trustees to sit down with us and led to this decision.
And Alicia Colmer, if you can talk about the efforts to block fossil fuel corporations from funding university research on the climate crisis. Earlier this year, a report by Data for Progress and Fossil Free Research, your group, looked into the influence of big oil and other polluters, what influence they have on higher education.
Definitely. So as you were just talking about with Rose, fossil fuel companies have continued to sow misinformation about climate change in order to deny climate action. And one of the ways they do this is by funding research at universities that leads for false climate solutions and helps them continue business as usual. And for them, business as usual is the continued destruction of our planet, right? So policymakers and legislators, they read these reports that come from prestigious universities, and they are much more likely to believe a quote-unquote climate research document if it at the top of the document it says MIT or Harvard, rather than it had a direct Exxon branding, though it might as well have a direct Exxon branding because all of that research is directly funded by these big oil companies. And so what we're trying to do is stop that pipeline, stop the fossil fuel money from coming and polluting our universities in the first place, so that universities can become real climate leaders, and so that universities can create real innovation, real climate solutions, and lead us to a just energy transition. And that's why we're demanding that universities stop taking fossil fuel money for climate research.
Finally, Dylan Wabi, what else do you think needs to be said as we move into what's happening on Sunday, this major march? And what inspired you to get involved with the whole issue of climate change?
I think I would encourage every single student to get organized and join the movement. There's over 100 Sunrise chapters across the country, and there's other incredible groups, Extinction Rebellion, YDSA and DSA chapters. And it's really through community organizing that we will have a voice, YDSA and DSA chapters. And it's really through community organizing that we will have a voice, YDSA and DSA chapters. And it's really through community organizing that we will have a voice, YDSA and DSA chapters.
We're going to have to leave it there. It seems that Dylan's voice has gone into a loop. Dylan Wabi and Alicia Colmer are co-founders of Sunrise NYU. Coming up, we go to Washington, where Hunter Biden has been indicted on gun charges. It is the first time in history that the child of a sitting president has been indicted. Stay with us.
Walmart.
Start to tremor. Wonder if he's gonna leave.
happening by Spirit of the Beehive. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, federal prosecutors have indicted President Biden's son, Hunter, on felony charges, illegally possessing a handgun, making false statements in order to obtain a revolver in 2018. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 25 years in prison and fines of up to $750,000. The special counsel now, David Weiss, brought the charges after a Trump-appointed federal judge in July rejected a deal that would have seen Hunter Biden plead guilty to two misdemeanor tax counts in order to escape more serious charges. It's the first time in U.S. history the Justice Department has criminally charged the child of a sitting president. This comes as Republican lawmakers have opened an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. We're joined now by Ryan Grimm. He's the D.C. bureau chief for The Intercept. His Substack newsletter is titled Bad News. Upcoming book, The Squad, AOC and the Hope of a Political Revolution. Ryan, thanks for joining us. First, talk about this. Well, it is a historic indictment. The first time the child of a president, he's hardly a child, but has been indicted.
It is a historic indictment, but it's also kind of a letdown in a sense for, you know, for people who really want to see Hunter, you know, thrown up against the wall, because it's kind of a ticky-tack charge. And it's kind of a charge that the right is going to want to see, you know, the Second Amendment absolutists are going to want to see thrown out. And Hunter's lawyers actually made this argument that, look, you can go ahead and make this charge and you can probably get in a conviction in front of a jury because the facts are, everybody's innocent until proven guilty. But it looks like he did fill out the form saying he wasn't, you know, using drugs at the time that he was buying this weapon. And that was not true. He was, according to his own memoir or whatever, unless he wants to try to argue that in that, you know, discreet moment, he wasn't using drugs. And so Second Amendment absolutists are going to say, look, there is no requirement in the Constitution that says you have to be sober or that you can put any conditions or restrictions whatsoever on gun ownership. Now, I would argue that that kind of cuts against the whole idea of a well-regulated militia, but we're 200 years past that at this point. So you could easily see an appeals court toss out this conviction, which would then lead to, paradoxically or ironically, an expansion of gun rights at the hands of Hunter Biden, ironically.
I mean, it's fascinating. You didn't see Republicans while they're disappointed that this didn't go deeper. And it's very interesting, the head of the Oversight Committee, Comer, who wasn't able to come up with anything on President Biden, yet McCarthy has just announced, the House Speaker, that they are starting this impeachment inquiry against him, said this is probably the one charge that President Biden has nothing to do with.
It is. That's true. There's no reason to think that the big guy, as the right calls him, based on that email, that famous or infamous email, would have had anything to do with this whatsoever. It's the most cordoned off crime that he would have committed. Everything else, from the Republican perspective, has at least some kind of tangential connection potentially to President Biden, whether it's the tax charges or the foreign influence peddling. This is just a messed up guy, lying on paperwork to buy a gun.
That he wasn't taking drugs when, in fact, he said in his book that he was taking drugs. Actually is evidence from his own book. But as Abby Lowell points out, and as the Republicans would underscore in any other case, this is a violation, they are saying, of the Second Amendment. So talk about the context in which this is happening in the opening of this impeachment inquiry into President Biden. Do you feel that it has something to do with, well, as President Trump runs again for president, then he can say, when people say the twice indicted president, Trump, we've all been indicted. We've all been impeached.
And maybe this will become the norm, that if the House of Representatives is controlled by the opposite party, there will be pressure from that party's base to indict the president if the president, I mean, not to indict, to impeach the president if the president is from the opposite party. So you could just, which then kind of strips it of a lot of its power. But yes, so what basically happened is that it seems like Kevin McCarthy got word that Matt Gaetz was going to give an extended speech, his own indictment, so to speak, of Kevin McCarthy when the House came back this week from its August recess. and say that he was going to, if McCarthy didn't live up to the bargain that was struck back in January, make a motion to vacate the chair, basically kick McCarthy out of his speakership. And McCarthy kind of scrambled quickly to make this announcement that he was going to open an impeachment inquiry, but not send that to the House floor for a vote, which means that, you know, whatever moderate Republicans are left don't have to kind of don't have to walk the plank on an unpopular vote back in their kind of Biden supporting districts. Steve Bannon on his podcast said that it looked like McCarthy had bayonets in his back. And in fact, he did. And what he means is that people like Gates and Bannon kind of forced McCarthy into this position. And so the White House is saying, if you don't put this on the floor for a vote, what we can do is refer to the legal counsel memo written by President Trump's attorneys that say that if the House doesn't vote on an impeachment inquiry, it's not an impeachment inquiry. Kevin McCarthy getting up in front of a bank of microphones and declaring it does not make it so. And so you have therefore not actually opened up the powers of impeachment yet. If you want to do it, you have to put people on record saying that they want to move forward on this.
And is the reason he's hesitating to do it is he's afraid that even among the Republicans, he's not going to have the votes right. He needs.
Because he only has a cushion of around four votes. And so
George Santos, if that's his name.
That's right. Although Santos will do whatever McCarthy asks him to do, ironically. Usually somebody from that district would be the kind that would be, you know, less willing to make a move against Biden if Biden, you know, is popular in that district. But because Santos has the problems that he has, he's just doing whatever McCarthy says he does because his job depends on it.
And what
McCarthy.
Happened yesterday, the meeting in the Republican caucus with the F-bombs flying and the House Speaker McCarthy saying you can make an effing move for a motion as they want to unseat him, this leading to possibly a government shutdown by the end of the month?
It's an incredible time for this to be happening because, like you said, if they don't produce a continuing resolution or some type of spending bill by September 30th, the House shuts down. The House had been saying they don't want to do a continuing resolution. They want to do their own appropriations bills the way that the House is designed to work. You're going to pass all 12. They'll go through the House, go through the Senate, signed by Biden, normal functional government. In the face of that, they have 2 weeks to pull all that off. Yet they're spending all of their time, you know, shouting at each other and saying they're going to impeach Biden and also throw McCarthy out of the speaker's chair. So they're not going to pass their appropriations bills. They're also saying if you try to pass a CR, a continuing resolution that just keeps the government open, we're going to throw McCarthy out of the speakership. So the only two paths to keep the government open are those two paths. And their dysfunction is ruling out the former. And the Freedom Caucus is ruling out the latter. So it does seem like they are headed for a shutdown of their own making. Like that, they won't even be able to spin it in any serious way that it was Democrats' fault.
Ryan Grimm, we want to thank you for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, MAD, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.